we can get started. So I'd like to welcome you to the first EW seminar this semester. And today we have the pleasure of having Professor DeSantis be the speaker. And I thought, well, I should tell you a few words about his background. He actually obtained his undergraduate degree from the National Technical University in Athens, both a bachelor's degree in chemical engineering and a master's degree in automation. That was 2002-2003. He then moved to Princeton, where he obtained his PhD degree in 2008. He worked with the late Professor Chris Flutas, who, as you know, very unfortunately has passed away. And with Chris Flutas, he did, you know, a number of interesting, you know, works related from all the way from global optimization, material design, and other related areas. And after he finished his PhD, he actually stayed as a he went actually to McKinsey, the consulting company, for 2 years. So he actually has experience in that world. And after that, he still decided to go back to Princeton, 2010-2013, as a postdoc. And again, you know, was also, I would say, one of the people instrumental in helping Chris Flutas, you know, consolidate some of the work in the last areas that he worked on. I should also say an interesting thing: during the period that he was a postdoc, Chrysantos went to the Greek Navy, because you need to do a military service in Greece. So Chris has also that kind of experience, if you're needed for anything. Seriously, in terms of the research work, just very briefly, Chrysantos has concentrated in the area of process operations, and in particular logistics, and I would say he's definitely an expert in the area of vehicle routing, and within that also, that's going to be the topic today, the topic of area of optimization under uncertainty, and in particular, robust optimization. I should also say that in addition to the process operations area, he also has interest in the area of materials design, where he's been active, especially with the NETL project, and also the other area is network optimization. And I should say that, you know, Chrysantos is right now a group of 5 PhD students, has supervised 12 master's students. So since he joined here in 2013, he's been a very active member of the process systems engineering group. So we're obviously very happy to have him being part of the effort here, both the PSC and in particular the CAPD. Okay, so without further ado, let me just, introduce Chrysantos, who's going to talk about modern robust optimization opportunities for enterprise optimization.
Okay. Ignacio, thank you so much for the kind introduction and for the invitation to give the seminar. Thank you, everybody, for being here. Thanks, everybody, over the teleconference for listening to this talk. So what I would like to do here is essentially provide some perspectives, as I have developed them, about robust optimization, where the field is going, and what opportunities exist, you know, for our consortium and for work we do in the EWO space. Uncertainty, of course, is present in essentially all decision-making contexts we want to engage, whether we want to deal with it or not. The fact is that it's there. For EWO, of course, you have a lot of uncertainty about the market. You have a lot of unexpected events that may disrupt your operations, the equipment malfunctions, and so on and so forth. And of course, you have uncertainty just because you don't understand the physics of your system very well. If you are engaged with a production process, you don't know the thermodynamics, the kinetics. All of that provides for some challenge. And of course, I don't have to preach to the choir here that it would be nice if you could to kind of take uncertainty into account while you're trying to do decision making. We've seen that a lot in the WO conferences and meetings we have. It is always a prevalent topic. Now, for EWO, under uncertainty, there are a lot of challenges. I would like to recognize 2 major ones. The first is that the EWO models typically have a large combinatorial component. We typically have mixed integer models with lots of discrete decisions, large MILPs and sometimes MINLPs. Sometimes these are so large that we cannot just solve them directly. We have some elaborate decomposition schemes or advanced algorithms that we develop custom-built for the application in question. And another important, if you will, element is that this discreteness sometimes is prevalent not just on the decision side, but also on the uncertain parameter side. We have disruptions. They may happen or they may not happen. And discreteness of uncertain parameters is something that has not been handled consistently, at least. It's only, if you will, recent developments that kind of allow us to handle those. The other problem with EWO is that typically we have multi-stage horizons. And what do I mean by that is that we're solving an optimization problem now. Within the scope of that model that we are solving, we typically basically decide for decisions that in practice are going to be implemented in various points in time moving forward, not necessarily immediately after we make those decisions. And in between certain sets of decisions, we typically have the opportunity to learn some of the information, some of the uncertain information. And that's really what defines whether a decision is a second stage versus a third stage or a fourth stage and so on. So we deal with these multi-stage horizons. Here I'm trying to, if you will, I don't know if people over the WebEx can see the pointer. I'll try to use this pointer instead of a laser pointer here. Hopefully it's going to work out. So what I'm trying to, I guess, illustrate with this notation, not doing a great job, is that in principle, your decisions would depend, your ideal decisions would depend on what you have seen in the past. And your uncertainty could potentially actually be dependent on your decisions themselves. So you may be able to inform the risk that you're being exposed to, especially when you deal with those endogenous uncertainty type of parameters. So this is a very, very general setting and very difficult to address as a whole, but this is really what we are facing. Multiple paradigms fall into this multi-stage decision-making paradigm. You invest now, and then every fiscal year you have to operate your plant, and you would like to come up with a solution that's collectively good. You may place or receive an order now and then have to figure out how to do the material through your supply chain. You are implementing some control, and you are deciding now on the control actions for the whole control horizon and so on and so forth. Ideally, we want to set up a decision support system that can work autonomously. It will automatically receive the input and the data from the system. It will run the optimizer in the background. It will automatically transmit the decisions. We know that doesn't work in practice very well, but in general, when you have this type of horizons, you do a rolling horizon approach. So you solve one problem now, and after a while, when some of the data has been revealed, you try to reoptimize. And you will do that even if you are based, you are working with a deterministic model or a model under uncertainty. However, what I want to point out is that how often you actually get to reoptimize is typically dictated by how often you can optimize, which is the tractability of the model. This may or may not be very compatible with the number of stages as defined before, or your need, which are defined essentially by the scope of the problem you want to solve. And the number of stages actually that you want to really consider is dictated by your need to locate better solutions. So the more the stages you concurrently take into account as you optimize, the better, obviously, because you look further into the future and have a potential to understand how future events and future decisions, how current decisions may actually affect your ability to do good decisions later. So in the best case scenario for us, those two timescales actually match, and after every stage, your model is fast enough, so after every stage, you can actually re-optimize. In a bad case scenario, the problem is not very tractable, and you may re-optimize after you've already implemented, let's say, T stages of decision. So what I want to say about this is that there is a need for high-quality wait-and-see decisions, because in many contexts, we will actually have to adopt those decisions. Just because they're wait-and-see doesn't mean they are less important to us right now. It means that before we get to execute them in practice, we may have learned a little bit about the uncertainty. Also, if we can do multi-stage, that's good, because the likelihood of closed-loop feasibility is higher the more stages you account. Because essentially, if you don't account for stages T plus one and so on and so forth, you are effectively assuming that the optimizer assumes implicitly that the best case scenario is going to happen moving forward, and that's not going to be the case. So for robust optimization, which is one way to deal with these types of problems, robust optimization has a game theory interpretation. You are the decision maker, you're trying to minimize your objective. Some sort of adversary nature is the second player who's trying to basically make your life difficult and tries to minimize your feasibility margin. This whole, if you will, field has its foundations in the Minimax criterion of Wald and later formalized as pessimistic optimization by Soyster. The main idea is that you are attempting to find the solution that will perform best in the worst case. Quotes here, I'm going to have to talk about this later. Which also implies that you are looking for a solution that remains feasible under all scenarios you are interested in insuring against. So, sorry about that. Some references, there is a seminal book by Bental, 2009. There is a very comprehensive review paper back from 2011 here, a SIAM review paper. If you are not familiar at all with robust optimization, maybe the best place to start is the paper by Den Hertog, a practical guide to robust optimization. It's a very easy read. Here I'm also listing a six-pager I wrote in the context of a similar talk I gave in the FOCAPO conference. That's also kind of a light read, and it kind of also discusses the perspectives I'm discussing now. So, archetypal robust optimization, single stage. So here, this is your model. You're trying to make decisions X, minimizing objective constraints. There are parameters Q, which are constants in the deterministic model. Under uncertainty, these are still constants, but you don't know their value. The way the robust optimization model is formulated is as follows. You are looking for a decision X that will remain feasible no matter the realization of your uncertainty, as long as your realization is from some sort of postulated uncertainty set, calligraphic Q. So you're looking for the decisions that are robust feasible, and out of all of those decisions that are robust feasible, you're looking for the one that provides you the best worst case was cut. Anyways, I was discussing the archetypal robust optimization setting. I don't know how much of this you've heard, but the idea here is that you have a deterministic model, and when you convert it to a single-stage robust model, you are looking for a decision that remains feasible under all possible realizations within a postulated uncertainty set, such that a worst-case objective is minimized. How do you solve that model? That model is the same as the model shown here. So the standard approach entails a reformulation. We're introducing a dummy variable here, Z, that it's essentially an epigraph variable. And then the semi-infinite constraint here for every Q in Q is essentially handled, is essentially reformulated as max of G under all possible Qs should be less or equal than zero. So this is mathematically equivalent to the one on the left side. And then what we're going to do is we're going to basically go constraint by constraint and dualize the left-hand sides, turn the max problems into min problems, after which we can simply drop the min operator. And this on the very right here is essentially a robust counterpart. It's essentially a monolithic model that you can just, a well-defined optimization problem that you can just solve. That's the benefit of doing this approach, is that you can solve it with just a call to an optimization solver that you have access to. The downside is that it's restricted to settings where this dualization can happen when stroke duality holds. That essentially means convex uncertainty sets and continuous uncertain parameters in general. And also another downside is that this is a very large problem. It will grow very quickly as the uncertainty set grows. I mean, if you think about it, for every original uncertain parameter that you have in your problem, you are generating a constraint per original constraint of your deterministic problem. And similarly, for every facet correlation that you are postulating in your uncertainty set, you're generating a variable per original constraint of your original problem, which means that it can add up to a lot. And of course, a lot of those constraints are not active at the optimal solution, so it's kind of redundant to have them in the first place.
This is usually for linear problems or also non-linear?
This could work for non-linear, as long as you can have convex uncertainty sets and dualize. The thing is that you are ending up with non-linear constraints to your robust counterpart, which means it's still a global optimization problem. Another approach to do this would be in a cutting plane approach, a little bit more algorithmic, more dynamic. So you're going to start, let's say, with your deterministic solution, and then you're going to solve a separation problem. You're going to look through your constraints, and you're going to try to identify realizations of your uncertainty that violate the constraints, that your current decision violates the constraints. You are going to then impose those constraints in some sense deterministically for the particular realization that was the offending one. And you're going to keep enforcing robustness dynamically. It's essentially a cutting plane approach. This is very useful in certain settings. First of all, it can accommodate non-standard settings. It can accommodate discrete parameters, for example. It can also accommodate non-mathematical optimization-based solvers. Maybe some of those separation problems are shortest path problems or some sort of min-cut-max-flow problems. You don't have to really have an MILP module to solve those. You can solve them with some sort of very specific algorithm, and this can be very, very fast in general. You can find those efficiencies. Downside is that there is no package that does that automatically for you. You will have to build it from scratch, which means elaborate implementation, and you'll need to tune it. So, perspective here, when to consider robust optimization. Ignacio keeps saying to us, I fully agree with him, that you should only do it when you can solve the deterministic problem. There is no panacea here. I mean, if you cannot solve the deterministic problem, you can certainly not solve an uncertainty aware problem on top of that. It's not that robust optimization will save you here. You should do it when feasibility is important. If violating constraints means that people will die. If you cannot monetize the infeasibility, for example, a lot in stochastic programming, for example, a very standard assumption is the full recourse assumption. You allow for infeasibility of certain scenarios, and you penalize it in the objective. Now, if the infeasibility of a given constraint is directly translatable to dollars, that's fine, you should do that. But if it's not, then your parameter there is an arbitrary parameter, which means that all your solution is subject to essentially inaccuracies that you have introduced. And that is really not the right thing to do. Robust optimization does not need that in the sense that you directly enforce feasibility. If you have a large number of parameters, robust optimization may be tractable. You can probably do 200-300 uncertain parameters, especially if those participate sparsely in the constraint, so not many parameters together. If you don't have joint probability distributions and you can't set up a very reliable, I guess, scenario tree, you may want to consider describing your uncertainty via an uncertainty set. And you need well-motivated, strong correlations among parameters. If you don't have that, you essentially default to a cube. Everything is independently going between a lower and upper bound, which is a Soyster approximation, and it's essentially very conservative. A lot of people don't like robust optimization because it's very conservative. All I have to say is that you get to choose as a modeler what uncertainty set you insure against. You can make it large or small depending on your preference. And essentially, and certainly you can actually take distribution information into account if you do have that. Very quickly, some uncertainty sets that you can use. You can use ellipsoids. Here is all your historical data. 95% confidence interval, you can use that ellipsis. You can postulate correlation. So let's say all parameters are within lower and upper bounds, but then not all hell can break loose on you at the same time. So, you know, some parameters are positively correlated or maybe negatively correlated among each other. Aggregate forecasts of demand, for example, fall in this category. You can do what we call a factor model. Essentially here, what you have is you have a certain parameters Q, and you have some auxiliary random variables, lower dimensional variables C, and you can project the original space of uncertainty down to a smaller dimensional space by using some sort of PCA type of analysis on your data. And then you can basically say that you can then say that the uncertainty will realize within a bounded disturbance around the nominal value in the space of Xi. They use that a lot in finance industry. They call them zero net alpha models to describe volatility of, you know, their the assets. You cannot certainly, you know, consider every single stock available in the stock market as a separate uncertain parameter. You can use the gamma sets. The famous Bertie-Mass and Sim uncertainty sets. Essentially, here it says that you're going to limit the number of parameters that can maximally deviate from their nominal values. So in this case, this is the nominal value, three uncertain parameters, but at most one can go to its max. You're ending up with this simplex. Gamma equals 2 gives you some shape like that. You can do discrete sets, where you just have a collection of discrete scenarios. Under certain settings, let's say linear models, single stage, and all the stuff, you can replace the scenarios with a convex hull and come up with a simple polyhedron. I'm a proponent of polyhedral sets. The last four of the five are polyhedral. They're more numerically tractable. They would maintain the class of your deterministic counterpart when you dualize. So if your model is MILP, like a lot of EW models, I don't think it would worth, let's say, going with a nonlinear uncertainty set, bumping up your problem class to a nonlinear problem, just because you want to be a little bit more elaborate on describing your uncertainty. You can always do an over approximation. You can also use a lot of standard machine learning techniques to derive that type of polyhedra from data directly, and typically they would give you kind of linear correlations. So a general polyhedral uncertainty set looks like that. One last thing I want to say about archetypal robust optimization is that it has a main limitation, exactly that it's a single stage. And if you use this, you are effectively foregoing your ability to wait and see decisions, and you have to take everything here and now. A corollary of this is that you cannot do equalities with robust optimization, single stage. Exactly because you have to decide the single value for them. So here is, let's say, a problem. I want to decide x1 and x2. I have a single queue, and I have a single uncertain parameter, uncertain constraint that must be satisfied for all these scenarios. Essentially, what I'm trying to solve with this robust optimization model is this model, right? The constraints should hold for each and every scenario. And as long as these scenarios are different values, Larry can tell you or prove to you that the only solution to this optimization model is this solution. And that essentially means, typically, in practice, do nothing. Don't operate your plant, don't invest, don't make money, keep everything shut down, which is robust feasible. Okay. But it's not the solution you want. You can effectively do state variable elimination, solve, let's say, x2 as a function of x1 in q, and plug that into your model. But in certain models you can do that and you can get away with it. But essentially what you did at that point is that you foregone your opportunity to know what x2 is here and now, which essentially means is that you implicitly transform this into a two-stage optimization problem where you just said x2 is going to be a second-stage variable, and in fact you have what we call a decision rule against q. Okay, so we need two-stage problems in general. This is often called adjustable robust optimization, where some of your decisions are x to be taken now. So you're solving one model now at time zero, and that gives you x, which is what you're going to immediately execute. Then you're going to wait to see what was the real value of Q, and then you're going to execute the rest of your decisions, which is Y. And if you want to do it, the best thing you can do here is actually make a Y that's different for each Q. Adapt to what you actually saw in real life. So a specific Y may be optimal for scenario Q, but suboptimal for another. Ideally, as I said, Y of Q should be as generic function of Q as possible. Our ability to do that varies, and the various frameworks can be classified based on our ability to do that. Anything between no adaptivity at all the way to full adaptivity. For no adaptivity is essentially a static approximation of deciding a single Y for all the Qs. That's essentially ignoring the fact that it's a two-stage problem and solve it as a single-stage problem. For full adaptivity, you can actually have a very generic Y of Q. You can use some sort of Bender's approach to identify Y of Qs for various Qs of interest. You can do something called a columnar constraint generation, where the idea is to progressively identify violating scenarios, introduce a new set of Y variables just to ensure against that scenario, iterate, find other scenarios that are still not covered by, not insured by your current collective set of decisions, and move on like that. That's a very good approach. The only downside is that you may end up having to introduce too many variables, too many new policies, and after a point it may become problematic. But let me show you a simple context where this would actually work very well. So here you want to design a supply chain network. So essentially you have nodes in your supply chain network. You have a node that produces 3 units of your commodity, a node that produces 7, and a unit that actually absorbs 10. So you have to flow 3 from here and 7 from here. This is just a terminal node, and that's like a transshipment node. In this problem, there are also fixed costs to build those links and capacities, and so I'm going to ignore all of that. Let's just say it's purely try to minimize operational cost of doing that. So this is the optimal deterministic solution, total cost of 13, because you moved 3 units at a cost of 2 per unit and 7 units at a cost of 1 per unit. However, if you want to ask what will happen if a transportation link fails, up to 1 in this network, because of a weather event, disruption. Well, in this case, if it were this link that failed, this solution is infeasible because there's no way to actually move your product. If this link were to fail, the solution is infeasible. which actually means, which actually means that this solution is not going to cut it. Okay, it's not robust feasible. You need to build more arcs if you want to be robust feasible. Okay, this is the optimal solution in this case, because if this link fails, you're gonna route somehow differently. If this link fails, there is still a path to route product around. If any of these fail, your original solution holds true, remains feasible. So the worst case cost of this solution is 34, and an expected cost, let's say everything has equal probability of failing, is 18.4. If you want to allow up to two links to fail, you have to build a more robust network, which means a more costly network. The worst case for this is 55, the expected cost rises, and so on and so forth. If you want to insure against three disruptions, you cannot do it because there are only three links that can go in here, and there will be these three links could fail together, and then that would be a robust and feasible setting. So anyways, this would be a prime context to apply column constraint generation. The way that would work would be essentially is that you're going to start with a deterministic solution, and you are going to solve the separation problem and identify one scenario that's going to fail. And then you're going to say, you know what, under that scenario, I'm going to have a separate set of flows that insure me against this, and I'm going to loop through this until I figure out that I have a collective set of flow policies that you know, would eventually work in each and every possibility, combinatorial possibility here. There is this concept of finite adaptivity. The idea here is that, even if I could come up with 1,000 different policies to be fully robust, it's also difficult to convince everybody in my organization to, you know, read through them in the manual or train for them. So in human decision making, we like to have a small fixed number of potential contingency plans. So this is what we're trying to achieve here, is that where we pick the number of contingency plans K a priori, and we're trying to find the best K policies that will be robust feasible collectively. This is not how we do it, but mathematically, essentially, what we're doing is that our Y of Q would be one of K possibilities. ZK here is some sort of SOS set of variables. Another way to view this is you are effectively partitioning your uncertainty set. Let's say you are interested in being robust feasible against the whole cube. You're going to have up to four policies, and you're going to say if a realization from the green subset realizes, the green policy will play. If a realization from the red subset gets you to materialize, the red policy will be in effect, and so on and so forth. And then the whole question is, how do you do this? How do you partition the set, essentially? So you can do it heuristically, or you can do it actually with exact guarantees of optimality. So this is essentially a disjunctive algorithm we came up in order to be able to find K-adaptable optimal solutions under the very general setting of mixing as a recurse for two-stage problems. So it works like branch and bound. The idea here is that, let's say you have K equals 2, you have a blue policy and a green policy, and you're somewhere in your branch and bound. There is still white space here, meaning that those two policies are collectively not robust. You're going to separate and find a new point that you're not insuring at this point, and then you're going to branch upon the restriction that, hey, this new point should either be one of the blue points or should either be one of the green points. By doing that, you are essentially, you can then, you know, utilize branch and bound principles, fathom when you can, and eventually come up with a proof of optimality of having found the best possible green and blue policies that are collectively robust feasible for your two-stage optimization problem with mixed integer recurse. Okay, some results here. Essentially what shows, again, some sort of sparse type of problem with a certain cost. The x-axis here is basically the static robust solution. This is the k equals 2. So with just a second policy, I can have a significant improvement. And with more policies, I can have more improvement, but there are diminishing returns. And what we see here is that with very few contingency plans, let's say 3 or 4, you've reaped all the benefits. So actually, when you do k adaptability, k is typically small, and you can actually feel confident that you are still more or less almost fully adaptive. Another interesting fact about the branch and bound algorithm is that it very quickly identifies upper bounds. It actually identifies solutions very, very quickly. So it can be used also as a heuristic, even if you cannot really run it to full optimality. Same conclusions here, different problem, and we have others. I'm not going to bother you with that. So another thing you can do in this continuum of adaptivity is what we call decision rules. Okay. you're going to forget about trying to be optimal in some sense. But what you're going to say, you're going to postulate that y of q is going to be some, it is going to actually adhere to some specific functional form, psi of q. Okay. Not necessarily the optimal functional form, but something that you can, you know, handle later down the road numerically. So you are going to postulate that. That's called the decision rule. You're going to try to, this has parameters which become, you know, optimization variables for you. You're trying to find the best psi of q, the best function of this family psi, such that if you, you know, if you use it as your policy, you're going to do the best in terms of solving your problem. And there are many variants, affine, piecewise affine, binary quadratic polynomial, and so on and so forth. I'm going to just focus on the affine because, it, in my opinion, it is also the only thing you can reasonably think of doing tractably for multi-stage problems as well. So here's how affine works in a multi-stage setting. A multi-stage setting, again, is a setting where you solve one optimization problem and you have to decide x, you have to decide y1, y2, y3, yn, a number of wait-and-see stages, in between each of which you're going to have realizations of different parameters. So information gets revealed progressively. In between revelations of information, you have to take decisions. You have to observe non-anticipativity. That's very important. And this is essentially the type of problems you have in scheduling, inventory planning, any sort of multi-period horizon for which you can define an operation for each and every period. Here is a scheduling example. This is an optimal solution. This is a Gantt chart. This is multi-stage as because of the following reason, right? There are multiple points in time where you actually have to commit to decisions. The operator didn't have to commit at time zero that he's supposed to turn the knob at 4.2. You know, he can, you know, he can actually commit to that decision, you know, just 10 minutes before that. So in theory, if you wanted to be really ideal here, you would wait until you actually know whether you should turn the knob here or not. At the same time, tasks finish and a lot of uncertainty associated with them gets revealed to you once they finish. So whether the batch was cooked correctly, whether the yield was there, whether it finished on time, and so on and so forth, is actually information that you learned throughout the horizon at various points in time, which themselves are variable in this case, mind you. So you have this multi-stage setup in this situation. So when you try to decide whether to start those very first tasks, these are here in our decision. You just do it. But as you move in time, and by the time you have to commit to that second red task, some things have already finished. So in theory, you could change your decision about whether to do it, how much to load in that reactor, and so on and so forth. And the tasks that have already finished and parameters associated with those tasks have already been revealed to you. When you go down to the third stage, if you will, more information has been revealed, fewer decisions remain to be done. And again, this is a receding horizon, but it could be a rolling horizon. So, but all I'm trying to say is that decisions moving forward can be informed by things that are ticked with the green ticks here, and so on and so forth. So this is a multi-stage problem. So you can actually address it using affine decision rules. So in the affine decision rules theory, what you're going to do is you're going to postulate affine functions of Q, and you're going to replace your Ys. Okay. These U's and these V's are the intercepts, and these U's are slopes, and they're all decision variables. Okay, you have a lot of them. In order to enforce non-anticipativity, you have to be very careful. As you can see, this is everything here is zero. We've turned them to zero, because if you didn't turn them to zero, you would have to choose something at the second stage that informed by something that hasn't been revealed yet, which would be anticipative. So you, just in order not to do that, you're turning everything to zero. And as a small caveat here, there are settings like in scheduling where there is a gray line here and the diagonal is not really very visible, exactly because Y3 may, because it's associated with a task that delayed, may actually end up after Q3 or, you know, before Q4. So exactly what exactly do you turn zero around the diagonal is actually, you have to be very careful, and it's a little bit more than meets the eye here. But in a very clean setting, everything, it should be lower triangular, everything above the diagonal should be zero in order to be non-anticipative. You're going to do this, you're going to end up, you're going to solve your problem, and you're going to be very, very degenerate. The reason is that I just introduced hundreds of variables. You know, I could trade a little bit of U3, 3-3 in order to gain a little bit of U3-2, and the whole sum here would be exactly the same. So the way you actually do this is you are doing a polishing step. You're solving a second problem after you get a solution as follows. So this is how you should correctly implement affine decision rules. Is first of all, you're going to apply them. This is your original two-stage model. You do this transformation. You have this robust counterpart. Be careful to make sure to apply all these implicit constraints here. For example, if you had the second stage variable that's positive, don't forget to write that u plus uq should be also positive, right? Because this is a new constraint in your model. This is your affine decision rules counterpart. You solve it. Okay, this is, let's say, an MILP. You're going to get an optimal first stage decision, an optimal objective for that problem, and an optimal set of affine rules. But it's very degenerate, and there is no reason why these affine rules are the best for your application. So what you're going to do is you're going to lock the x's in place, and you're going to search for another robust solution that is as good as the optimal. So you're only searching out of all the equivalently optimal, equivalently because of degeneracy and a lot of degeneracy that exists in this problem, solutions. And out of all of those solutions, if other exists, that is, you may want to maximize some other metric that makes more sense. For example, let's say the one that will perform best in the nominal scenario, or the one that will perform best in expectation. So you can actually do that. Because if you rely on this solution, it may lead you to very, you know, to numerically unstable like solutions with very high coefficients that don't make much sense in order to implement, and so on and so forth. This is much more numerically robust, if you will, to do for implementation. So we've done that for scheduling. The idea. So here, very quickly, the orange is a static robust optimization approach, what had been done before. The gray is what you can do if you do two stage. As you can, and the blue is something called worst case deterministic. It's an anticipative lower bound to the best solution you can ever get. It is not attainable. There is always improvement. This is the worst case maxpan, so we have uncertainty in processing times here. So we solve the problem. So at the worst case, we guarantee better solution. What is really interesting with the ARO kind of the affine decision rules kind of approach is that, exactly because it adjusts, you capitalize on better than worst case realization. So in expectation, let's say, the solutions would actually work better in expectations, right? Because what you do actually is informed by what you are observing in the plant. If you observe something good, you're going to do something good. The worst case scenario is very unlikely anyway, it's the way we construct the sets. Whereas the static robust solution cannot really adapt, so it actually stays there. So in expectation, you're doing much, much better. You can actually solve zero-weight problems with zero-weight states. So zero-weight means that the moment a task completes, this product is so unstable it needs to immediately move to the next task. Okay, but if you're uncertain, the processing time is uncertain, you don't know when you solve the model when the preceding task may finish. So you cannot really schedule the next task to start exactly when you want to do it. This is implemented in most scheduling models as conditional big M conditional equalities implemented as big M constraints. So although you don't have an equality constraint, it's the same problem the static RO has with equality constraints. With our framework, you can actually do zero weight, which is for the first time you can actually solve this type of problems robustly. You can also solve problems, scheduling problems, with uncertain yields. Again, yields are uncertain parameters that go into material balances. Those are equalities. You can't handle them with robust optimization, but you can handle them with two-stage robust optimization. This is a case of a multitasking scheduling process. So this is very standard in, let's say, analytical lab services, where you have essentially, 100 vials of the red sample and 120 vials of the green sample, and they're going to undergo, certain tasks, let's say, into a centrifuge, and they can go together. So a particular machine can concurrently process 50 vials of this and 50 vials of this because it has 100 slots and you can put whatever you want. But because these are different samples with different origins, they will have to follow a different sequence of tasks. So you have multiple STNs concurrently encoded in this. What is interesting here is that when you do uncertainty in the yields, you can actually handle cases where a particular task creates off-spec material. So let's say, for some reason, P3 is unstable, and you get the samples through this this machine. You take them out, and you realize, they haven't spin too much, and you have to put it back. And you want to plan for all of this and the possibility for all of this. Okay, so if something is off spec, it has to be reprocessed. I mean, you can define what that means. You can just send it back to do the same task. You can send it back to the beginning to do everything together. You can send it back at different stages depending on what type of batch you came from. But the main concept here is that as you are defining those recycle streams, you can use the concept of an uncertain yield, okay, to model this, because you have a yield towards P4, you have a yield towards P1, you have a yield towards P3, you have a yield towards P2. The sum of all those uncertain parameters should sum up to one, but what is the exact value of those parameters would be uncertain, depending on the likelihood of things failing and having to go back to given stages. So our ability to solve scheduling problems with uncertain yields allows us to solve this setting, and here are some results. A deterministic schedule would give you, let's say, 1600. A robust schedule will give you 1100, because you have to pay something to be risk averse. But the idea here, and these Gantt charts are plotted for the nominal realization, but it's robust feasible for all realizations, and this is actually shown here. These gaps here are exactly because you were anticipating some worse scenario to potentially be thrown at you. This assumes, I guess, uncertain yields in every machine. The total of 60 uncertain parameters, okay, can be handled in this particular setting. One last thing I want to cover before I close off with some final thoughts is to discuss a little bit the concept of endogenous uncertainty. Again, Ignacio has taught us a lot about this and how they do it in stochastic programming. Endogeneity of a parameter means that prior decisions that I make could potentially affect the realization of that parameter. It could affect whether it realizes or not to begin with. It may lose its physical meaning sometimes if I just don't do something. When it was going to realize, stage 2, stage 3, or 4, it could also change the distributional support. Maybe I invest in some better technology, which means I still don't know what is going to be, you know, the final yield of the process, but it's going to be on a higher range. Or if I don't invest in this good technology up front, I still don't know what the process yield is going to be, but it's going to be on the lower range because I didn't pay more money to develop technology. So in these cases, we have endogenous parameters, and it would be nice to actually model that because we would like to interplay with that and capitalize on that. We want to make decisions that lead us to risk exposure that is more manageable for us, and that overall this decision actually plays well for us. So the way we would do that in robust optimization would be by essentially defining decision-dependent uncertainty sets. So instead of having a constant set like here, I'm gonna basically make a set that's a function of W being, let's say, all my first stage decisions or my integer, my binary decisions. It has some sort of logic-based interpretation. V is something we call the materialization indicator. It's a decision variable. It's a function of W. It's a well-defined function of W. You can actually automatically get what V is from your deterministic model. I'm not going to go into the details. But essentially, you can actually generalize those sets into decision-dependent sets like that. Here's a case where you have three parameters. But if W2 in particular, W2, let's say, is that I actually do the task 2. If I do the task 2, the processing time of the task 2 may affect what's happening, right? But if I don't do the task 2, the processing time of that task is irrelevant. And I should be able I'm not exposed to that risk, and I should be able to dynamically switch my attention to an uncertainty set that's representative of what I'm facing. And this is really the case here. You can dynamically encode this. You have a set that ebbs and grows dynamically depending on what you're choosing. And you are always ensuring robust visibility against the risk that you are actually facing. So, again, if W2 is 0, you are working on the two-dimensional uncertainty set. If W2 is 1, you are working on the full blue set. You can do a number of things like with this general concept. You can modify the distributional information. So, for example, based on what technology I invest, the upper bound of what I can get on Q will change. Okay, that's a very simple case. You can control which scenarios remain relevant if you make decisions. Okay, so in this case, depending on the sum of W1 plus W2 plus W3, whether it's 0, 1, 2, or 3, I'm going to have different number of red dots being my scenarios of interest. Or I can do what I showed you before, where I dynamically change the dimensionality of my set from 3 to 2 to 1 and back into 3. Here are three settings where previously only possible with stochastic programming that now we can do with robust optimization. again, from mostly from Professor Grossman's work. Here's the standard capacity expansion problem. The idea here is that you have a decision to invest in some new process or not. If you do, the production yield of that process is uncertain, but it doesn't get materialized if you don't invest. It doesn't have physical meaning at that point. The demand is also uncertain in this problem, but that is always materialized. It's an exogenous parameter. In offshore oil production, again, you have to decide whether to drill somewhere or not. If you drill, something called the initial deliverability, how good the reservoir is, I guess, is uncertain to you, but it only retains a physical meaning if you go and drill there. Whereas the fact that there exists a field and it has an uncertain size is exogenous because it always retains its physical meaning. Here's clinical trial planning. This is the FDA process. You have three phases. You're trying to manage your research portfolio here. So at some point, you're going to have to make a call. Should I take the drug and pay some money and an effort to undergo phase two, or should I kill it now? If I do decide to go through the process, I have a binary uncertain parameter. It's going to fail or it's not going to fail, or it's going to pass. But if I choose not to undergo the process, then that random variable has no meaning to me, and I should be able to kind of take it away from my uncertainty description. So again, this type of tree-based processes are also amenable for this. This is how you would solve it if you did a gross over approximation of your uncertainty and tried to make it fit with traditional robust optimization with constant uncertainty sets. So you have low, medium, and high uncertainty. Obviously, the higher the uncertainty, the lower the profit. So that's the price of robustness going across rows. That makes sense. And these are the different problems. 100 is the deterministic. That's an upper bound to everything. This would be an approximation using constant sets. If you actually use the actual sets as we've defined them, which are the true representation of what's happening in reality, for the very same level of uncertainty, so same insurance against the very same risk, no discounts here on how robust we are, you can actually do much better. You can recover a lot of the conservativeness, if you will, that you would have had before. So for this case, comparing apples to apples, you go from 63 to 79. You've just recovered about 50%, 40 to 50% of your risk premium. Risk premium being defined as 100 minus 63. So now the risk premium is 100 minus 8. Okay, so this is actually very interesting, and there are more examples in the paper that fall into this paradigm. So my last slide, some opportunities for robust optimization to be used moving forward, which are also challenges because we need to figure out how to do all of these things well in our context. So modern robust optimization can, in principle, my perspective, I guess. Solve problems using cutting-plane-like approaches that progressively enforce the robustness of a solution. Okay. This allows us to capitalize on whatever deterministic optimization machinery we may have already installed in place. If we have the ability to solve something well, we should be able to take it to the next step without worrying about dualization and reformulations and all these limitations that may come from the theory. It provides more flexibility about what can be uncertain. For example, disruptions, as I said, uncertain parameters that are of discrete nature cannot necessarily be dualized unless they follow some total unimodularity kind of property. It allows for better integration with custom-built solvers, including metaheuristics. So maybe you have a metaheuristic solver, okay, not a math programming-based one, that essentially spits out good quality solutions that are feasible. Well, you could, in principle, use this to take it to the next step by making it a robust metaheuristic. Again, a metaheuristic, no guarantee of optimality, but it will be spitting out solutions that are robust feasible instead of merely feasible for some nominal scenario. Robust optimization can handle recourse, contrary to popular belief 5-10 years ago. I don't think it's popular belief anymore, including mixing the recourse in multi-stage decision-making settings. We have a path to full adaptivity for two-stage problems. Decision rules can be used to address multi-stage problems. You can also use this column constraint generation or the Bender's approach in a nested fashion, but I would say good luck setting it up and being tractable. I think decision rules, maybe not necessarily a fine, maybe something more complicated, could be very tractable even for end-stage problems. And it can obviously help you cope with equality or conditional equality constraints. And the final, I guess, takeaway is that we could do an endogenous uncertainty using decision-dependent uncertainty. So this is kind of new, but we should be able to bring robust optimization into those settings as well. So here are some references and acknowledgments of the students who did all this work. Without them, this would not be possible. Especially Anirudh, Nikos, and Akang are working currently on topics related to robust optimization. This is Logan Matthews. Logan is from Princeton. He's actually the last student that the late Professor Flutas had. He kind of stepped in trying to help. Actually, I was very lucky being given the opportunity to do that. He's a very good student, to help him finish his thesis. He's working on this network, supply chain network design. So appreciate government funding and support from a lot of friends and colleagues. So with that, thank you.
Thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much, Constantis. Very interesting seminar. So I think, as usual, we would like to see if maybe out there in the audience who's listening in industry, any questions to Constantis, any comments? Anybody would like to volunteer? We usually have shy people out there. So how about here in the room? Anybody would like to ask? Yeah, Salvador. Sorry.
Very naive question. To what extent does the robust nature of the optimizer prevent you from your solutions falling onto the constraints sequentially? I'm thinking of a scenario where your optimizer, as the information becomes available, throws the decision, first decision stuck to this constraint, next decision stuck to that constraint.
Yes, excellent point.
And then it becomes an unstable pattern. And like in the clinical studies thing, if you strain resources like crazy, that has other consequences, right?
Yes.
So how did you tune these things?
You're talking about conditional constraints. Aspect.
Yeah, like how do you tune it so that the recurring decisions are not at the edges of what you can do without falling in the obvious solution that Larry proposed, which is do nothing.
No, I said that he can prove to you that that's the only solution. He may have a different way. Just to clarify, he's my boss we're talking about. Okay. I hope I'm going to answer your question via this. You are referring to contexts where the models, you have some conditional models where if something happens, some other part of the model applies and so on and so forth. In theory, you should be able to model this as a comprehensive model. That, in the deterministic sense, that means that in front of this GI less or equal than zero, you may have, if something is true, then apply this constraint. And you can do big game or whatever have you to do that. The way that implication, the product of that implication, would carry forward immediately, directly, without any needing to do anything down here. So if this constraint is not relevant, you will not do any robust optimization machinery to enforce robust feasibility against that constraint if it's not relevant, for the very same reason. So an implication constraint up here would result, where this is just the protasis, the apodosis, the right-hand side, would translate to an implication constraint here with the very same left-hand side and this thing as the right-hand side. So whatever challenges you may be facing in modeling that setting in the deterministic problem, you have to solve them at that level. When you solve them, none of these would have a problem going forward. So if that is a setting that you can do deterministically with one model, possibly via propositional logic. Now, propositional logic, there are multiple ways to optimize it, right? You can reformulate it, big game, and so on and so forth. You can do it dynamically as you do branch and bound, whatever. But conceptually, if the model is only applicable in certain subsets of your scope, the robust model should be relevant only to the very same subset of the same subset of the scope.
So I understand that the formulation count for appearing and disappearing constraints. But because of the appearing and disappearing constraints, as you take the new decision, right? What if that new decision is pushing you to a different side of the space from the previous decision you took? So then
you wouldn't allow that at that point because the range of possible decisions, Y2 in some capital Y2, that Y2 would be modeled such that it's only the right accessible space for those decisions given Q1. So
Maybe you can continue that a bit later now, because I heard, is somebody out there who wanted to ask a question? I heard some noise. Not really? Okay. How about here in the room? Anybody else would like to ask a question? Yeah.
So can everything that you would normally do with chance constraints be done with the same approach of robust optimization by constructing the right uncertainty set?
Yeah, I mean, one way to build uncertain sets is to essentially capitalize on distributional information you may have. And just as if you wanted to impose a constraint 95% probability, what you want to do is make sure that you include 95% like confidence in your uncertainty set, and then enforce robustly that. It would be equivalent in that sense for individual chance constraints, that is.
But do you see an advantage between approaching it in the traditional chance constraints way?
The main advantage is way before we get to that point, is to the point where I wouldn't have fine enough, you know, detailed enough joint probability distributions to be able to do that in the first place. Whereas I may have had some simplistic representation like this, and I would be able to do a row. If I have all the stochastic information in detail, you know, yeah, you can follow that, you can follow other approaches, and at that point, you know, you should try all. But there's equivalency.
Maybe if I can ask one question. I think, sort of looking at what you presented here, which is, of course, very interesting, it is sort of very clear that what you've been doing, in a way, I think, is to try to close a gap between robust optimization, the traditional, you know, very conservative, versus stochastic programming. So I think the question I would ask at this point is, how close are we to closing that gap? Because it would seem to me, I mean, ideas of recourse, multi-stage, and so forth, I mean, they've obviously been very prevalent on the one hand, and stochastic looks like a good part of them. You might be able to do them. So how far are we to close the gap? Why would one still try to do stochastic? Why would still try to do robust? And here, by the way, let me just also mention very briefly what's interesting in the scientific community, if you wish, this school of stochastic, the school of robust, they don't usually get along very well, but at least here we hopefully we'll be able to close that gap. So.
Well, stochastic had been around a long time before.
Right.
Robust came later and people didn't really formalize it. You did all this flexibility analysis work, which is very relevant too, but all of that didn't really become popular until late 90s or so. And around that time, it was also the whole optimization of the uncertainty community was dominated by stochastic programmers, and there was backlash a lot, you know. So I think there's a historical reason why that was the case. I'm not here on a mission to, you know, close any gap, whatever. I'm trying to develop.
No, but I think it's getting closer.
I guess my last slide alludes to the fact that robust could be used in a lot of contexts that in popular belief it couldn't. And the chance stochastic programming was the only alternative. I don't know if for those contexts it would be better to do robust, but it is available, and if you are in a research capacity or interested in an R&D capacity, you should try. Right. And there are, I think I try to allude to certain settings where I would feel robust is very strong, but again, you have to try.
Right.
Whether you have detailed distributional information or not is the key.
Right.
I would think that in a lot of... Yes, but feasibility, you say, just because you're doing robust doesn't mean you're always feasible. This uncertainty set is only 95% of your probability mass. So there is always a chance that some realization outside what you insured against still materializes.
Right.
So it is just that numerically it may work better in certain cases.
Okay. All right, well, maybe again on that note, let me thank very much Chrysanthus for an excellent talk. Thank you very much. And again, thank you out there to everybody. We'll, as usual, you know, place the slides in the web link that we have for the CAPD. Okay? Thank you.